We're going to hear later in the service about some famous Unitarians. So I have designed this meditation as we enter this time of silent meditation. I invite you to consider how the lives of our forebears hold us steady, how their words call us to be our best selves, and how their courage and love evoke our own. Our hope lies not only in the inner strength that our faith teaches us to nurture, but also in the example of those who went before to show us the way. Their lives speak to us, their deeds beckon. I invite you to follow the sound into the silence, reflecting on our faith's rich heritage and its potential to serve the world through our compassionate actions.
Thanks to modern technology and the miraculous ability to time travel, I've been able to travel back to 1579, and we are here in the royal dungeon at the castle at Deva, Transylvania. My guest this morning is Frank David, also known as Francis. May I call you Frank?
No, it's Francis. And if you should happen to write it, please use an I, not an E.
Sir, I understand that you are in the dungeon because you were convicted of the crime of innovation. Is that a fact?
Yes. I was questioning and challenging the traditional religious doctrine, especially the Trinity, and I was presenting new ideas.
Now, I thought that the 16th century was a time of religious toleration in Transylvania.
Well, that was true when King John Sigismund was our ruler. He realized there was no possibility of agreement among the various interpreters of proper doctrine. So he issued an edict that each person was free to support their own chosen understanding of Christian doctrine.
Now, at that time, the king's two advisors were you as the court preacher and George Biandrata as the court physician. Biandrata was also a skilled politician. Were you allies at that time?
We were. In 1568, King John scheduled formal debates on religious doctrine. The debates lasted 10 days. I represented the Unitarian position and relied on Scripture to buttress my arguments.
And what was the outcome?
Well, many in Transylvania embraced Unitarianism. A second debate, the following year, led the king to declare that he himself was Unitarian, and that there should be religious toleration in the land. His last public act in 1571 was to declare on the second page that and he gave Unitarianism legal recognition. Unfortunately, he died a couple of months later as a result of an accident, and there was no successor.
And who was his heir?
Well, a Catholic named Bathory, who dismissed me and most of the Unitarians in the royal court. He kept my buddy Biandrata, probably because he was a good physician and for his political savvy. They reaffirmed the policy of toleration to the religions named in the 1571 decree, but declared that they would not allow any further religious innovation. So there are no more new ideas.
And so how did you end up here in the dungeon?
Well, I became the Unitarian bishop, but I was still driven toward reform of doctrine rather than development of church organization. I was exploring questions having to do with the doctrine of the Lord's Supper, infant baptism, predestination, and the worship of Jesus. My buddy, Biandrata, who was more concerned with the health of the church than with matters of doctrine, urged me to keep quiet.
And I gather that you did not.
That's right. And the prosecutor at my trial was my old buddy, Biandrata, and he concealed his real beliefs when asked about his own earlier involvement in questioning religious doctrine. Yeah.
Thank you very much for granting this interview.
Well, I hope we can have another one.
Francis David died in the royal dungeon in November 1579. Biandrata went on to push the Unitarian Church toward more conservative theological positions. By the time Biandrata died in 1588, very little remained of the former influence in the Transylvanian Unitarian movement. The Unitarian Church was forced into a position of doctrinal stagnation that lasted more than 200 years.
April 1903, Toronto, Ontario. Lorna Leno here, and I'm speaking with Emily Stowe as she reflects on her life as a path-breaking woman physician and suffragist. Emily, you were born in Norwich, Ontario in 1831, oldest of six daughters. I understand you became a school teacher at the age of 15.
Yes, I taught at various area schools for 7 years. Receiving, like other women teachers at that time, half the salary accorded to men. I went on to attend the recently built Provincial Normal School in Toronto, the only advanced school open to women in British North America. I was appointed the first woman principal of a public school in Ontario.
And I understand you were married and had three children shortly after that?
Yes, indeed. That's right. But after the birth of our son in 1863, my husband John was diagnosed with tuberculosis and sent to a sanatorium. I returned to teaching, but found it very difficult economically. So I decided to become a doctor. So my sister helped out by caring for the children while I studied.
Well, I guess you went to the Toronto School of Medicine.
No, oh, you've got to be kidding. In 1865, when the vice president of the University of Toronto told me, the doors of the university are not open to women and I trust they never will be. I replied, then I will make it the business of my life to see that they will be opened, that women will have the same opportunities as men. But because I was unable to receive medical training anywhere in Canada, I attended the New York Medical College for Women, and two of my sisters later attended the same school.
And is it in the U.S. that you met Susan B. Anthony?
Yes. And from her, I learned that I would have to adopt a patient strategy, encouraging gradual progress when I was later advancing women's rights and suffrage here in Canada.
And your husband, he recovered from tuberculosis and trained as a dentist.
He did. He did, and we moved into a Toronto residence where we each had an office. Our son, Frank, eventually joined his father's practice, and in 1879, with the influence of a family friend who was the principal of Victoria College, our daughter, Augusta, was admitted and then went on to the Toronto School of Medicine. Upon graduation, she became the first woman doctor fully trained in Canada.
Quite an accomplishment.
Yes.
And what was your role with the suffragists?
Well, in 1889, I addressed the Ontario legislature asking for the vote for widows and spinsters. I just told them, as educated citizens, as moral and loving women, we desire to be placed in a position to impress directly our thought upon our nation and time. The legislators totally disrespected me, but it did lay the groundwork for more serious subsequent debate. Later that year, my friend, Susan B. Anthony, spoke at the Toronto City Hall and declared that disenfranchisement always meant not only political degradation, but social, moral, and industrial degradation as well.
A great pathway. And I understand you were a member of the Toronto Unitarian Church.
That's right. I signed the membership book in 1879.
Why did you stop practicing medicine in 1893?
Oh, what a nuisance that was. While attending an international women's convention in Chicago, I fell off the platform and broke my hip. John had died 2 years earlier, and I spent as much time as I could at our summer place in Muskoka, but stayed most of the time with my son's family in Toronto.
Emily died in 1903. The minister of First Unitarian Church in Toronto resided over her service at her home. It wasn't until 1918 that women were able to vote in Canada. Much of the credit goes to Emily Stowe, teacher, physician, suffragist, Unitarian. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you for joining us this morning. It is 1980, and I'm reporting to you from Ottawa, where Dr. Lotta Hitch-Mavona has just been awarded the Companion of the Order of Canada. This honor is one of many she has received. To name a few, 1915, the Chevalier of Public Health from the Government of France, and the Gold Medal from the Red Cross of France. 51, the Medal of St. Paul from Greece, 62, Public Service Medal from the Government of South Korea, 72, Officer of the Order of Canada, 75, Woman of the Year for India. She refused to accept honorary doctorates from universities, saying she had worked hard enough in Paris and Prague to earn her own doctorate. Dr. Hishmavona, congratulations.
Oh, please call me Dr. Lotta.
Dr. Lotta, thank you. Your awards stem from your humanitarian work through the Unitarian Service Committee, which we now know as the USC. When did you see this as your vocation?
I was born in Czechoslovakia in 1909 to an upper-class family of Jewish background who put much importance on social reform and education. I completed my PhD from Prague University, and I hold diplomas in 5 languages, French, English, German, Spanish, and Czech. I then studied journalism and political science at the Sorbonne in Paris, with a plan to take up a diplomatic career.
So that was prior to the Second World War, was it?
Yes, yes. In 1938, I returned to Prague and started freelance writing. My articles became increasingly anti-Nazi, and my name appeared on a German list of unfriendly journalists. I spent the next 4 years working all over Europe as a journalist, librarian, and interpreter, doing all I could to avoid detection by the Nazis. In 1942, I ended up in Marseille, France, poor and starving. Standing in a food line in the market, I fainted from hunger and exhaustion. I was taken to receive treatment at the Unitarian Service Committee Medical Clinic, an outreach of the American Unitarian Association in Boston. That was my introduction to Unitarians.
And did you move to the U.S. at that time?
That was my intention. But I was denied a visa to the USA. However, I was given one to Canada, a country about which I knew nothing. I got a job in Ottawa with the censorship department, reading German prisoner of war letters and gathering information for intelligence purposes. I tried desperately to locate my parents, but never could. It is believed they died at Auschwitz.
After the war, you formed a Canadian branch of the USC with the help of the Ottawa Unitarian Congregation. Is that so?
Yes, yes. But I did, but I kept the new organization formally distinct from the Unitarian Church, in order to avoid antagonizing funding resources or operating partners with different cultural, religious, or political backgrounds.
How involved were you?
I had decided to help war-sharped and war-mutilated children and other European refugees. They needed to find a future. At that time, I thought my job would be finished in 3 or 4 years.
At a 1973 Brock University lecture, you are quoted as saying, "There are 3 basic principles to the field of the art of giving aid. 1, to come as an open-minded friend and good listener when offering help. 2, to say goodbye to a project when it can continue on its own. And 3, to serve with a personal touch, because a relationship of confidence must lift your aid beyond the realm of a simple business proposition and prove that you really care."
Definitely. Since 1945, Canadians have helped destitute children in post-war Europe, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and in independent India and Bangladesh. 30,000 children's layettes were made for Palestinian refugee camps. A carload of Saskatchewan barley went to post-war Korea. Teachers and health facilities have been supported in India. This list of contributions is endless.
Did you ever marry?
No. My life has been obsessed by the images of need I see every moment during my overseas trips.
Dr. Lotta, I've heard that reporters and editors call you the atomic mosquito for your persistence in getting good media coverage. True?
Yes, yes, yes. Mm. I have found it necessary to call and berate an editor. If I felt my fundraising tour had not been given enough space in the local newspaper.
Fantastic. Dr. Lotta, I am so glad that you have granted this interview. Thank you. Thank you. You can be sure that it is being viewed by thousands.
Oh. Thank you.
The final irony is that Dr. Lotta, this articulate, passionate woman, spent the last years of her life suffering from Alzheimer's. She died of cancer in 1990. A memorial service was held at the Unitarian Church in Ottawa, of which she had been a longtime member. In 2007, the Canadian Museum of Civilization in Gatineau, Quebec, recognized Dr. Lotta's many contributions by including her in its permanent exhibition, Face to Face, the Canadian Personalities Hall, which showcases 27 fascinating people whose decisions, actions, and accomplishments shaped Canada. Most recently, some of you may have received an email from John Hopewell about Dr. Lotta and placing a vote for her as a nominee for the Canadian History Museum. Ladies and gentlemen, Madeleine Letterman and Lorna Wright, carrying on then.
Reporting from Victoria, BC, March 3rd, 2013. With me is Alice Monroe. Alice, you are receiving rave reviews about your latest collections of stories, Dear Life, published this past fall. The National Post refers to it as, and I quote, a collection of as rich and surprising as any in Alice Monroe's deep career. The Globe and Mail writes, Alice Monroe stories, understated, intense, resonant, nuanced, and profound. She is and has been for decades one of our most important writers, one whose work represents all the most essential and pleasurable aspects of literature, and which reminds us of what great literature is. Tell us where it all began.
Lorna, you're making me blush. Thank you. I was born and raised in Wingham, Ontario, in 1931, and many of my stories depict that small-town culture. I attended the University of Western Ontario, where I met my first husband, Jim Monroe. In 1963, we moved to Victoria, where we opened a small bookstore on Yates Street. That was the same year I published my first collection of stories, although I had written some stories prior to that, which appeared in literary journals and on CBC radio. I attended the Unitarian Church on Superior Street around that time.
Well, there's a Monroe's bookstore on Government Street.
Indeed, yes. The store moved to the larger premises in 1984. And by the way, Jim's current wife, Carol Sabiston, is the artist who designed and made the wall hangings which grace the front of this church.
Thank you for that information. Well, when did you leave Victoria?
I left in 1972 and returned to Ontario and became the writer in residence at the University of Western Ontario.
Well, your list of honors is impressive. Your fiction has earned 3 Governor General Awards, 2 Giller Prizes, and the Man Booker International Prize for Lifetime Achievement. As well, you have received the Canada-Australia Literary Prize, the Commonwealth Writer's Prize, and the O. Henry Award in the U.S. for continuing achievement in short fiction. And you're still going strong.
Yes, I'm very excited about the Alice Munro Festival being held in North Huron, Ontario, in September. It is held to provide a forum for writers to develop their craft and connect with like-minded literati. If you are interested in attending, Google Alice Munro Festival and you will find the information. I hope to see some of you there.
Thank you for being with us today, Alice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This is Madeleine Letterman
and Lorna Leno
signing off for This Hour Has Famous Unitarians.
Please join us next week when our featured guest will be the renowned theologian, Reverend Melora Lingood.